Welcome to My Favorite Mystic, a podcast about the weird and wonderful world of mysticism. I'm AJ Langley, and today I'm joined by Carl Chauvet. He's Associate Professor in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia. Carl, thank you for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on. I'm really excited to join you today.
Well, it is a pleasure to have you. We are doing another repeat Mystic episode this week because you are here to speak to us about Hildegard von Bingen.
Yes.
But of course, before we get into her, let's talk a little bit more about you. How did you get interested in mysticism as a field of study?
So it goes back a few decades to when I was a second year undergraduate at McMaster University in Hamilton, which is just outside of Toronto. And I was a religious studies major and becoming interested in lots of different aspects of the study of religion. And I was actually sort of channel surfing one night, which is what we did back, 20 years ago. And I came across a documentary that was on a Canadian channel called Vision TV. And I caught the beginning of a series called Mystic Women of the Middle Ages that really just kind of drew me in for a lot of different reasons. They used some music that was written during the period, especially by Hildegard. And the first episode that I caught was actually on Hildegard herself. And what really stood out to me as somebody who had just a very vague and passing familiarity with pre-modern Christianity was the surprise that there were so many women who played such an active role in the life of that particular religion and in society more generally. I think you tend to absorb this idea, feminism is a very modern phenomenon. Women were relegated to the domestic sphere prior to the 17th, 18th century. So it was kind of just totally mind-blowing to think that there were all these women who were politically active mystics who were writing a large number of treatises. And so I kind of followed this and then realized about halfway through that two of the hosts were professors at McMaster University. And they happened to be offering a course on that theme the next summer. So I took that with them. And then they very generously agreed to supervise an undergraduate thesis on the idea of bodily suffering and pain in medieval female mysticism. So I really got involved with it for a few years. Then I got an offer to do my master's at McMaster, and their graduate program in religion didn't really have many strengths in medieval studies generally. And so I wound up going, a few centuries earlier and studying Judaism and Christianity in late antiquity, which is where I went on to get my doctorate. But kind of sticking, at least in some parallel way, with the theme of mysticism, writing my dissertation on Latin commentaries from the 4th and 5th centuries. On the Song of Songs and talking about their connection both to conceptions of the church, but also to female virginity, which is another really kind of interesting topic, maybe counterintuitive to think that this very erotic love poem could be connected to defenses of the ascetic life. So I wrote that as a book that came out in 2016 and have kind of been working my way back in the last couple of years through a broader study of this theme of the Bride of Christ and particularly how it ties to women's identities, and have started writing again on Hildegard. I've got a couple of essays coming out and a few projects that are on the horizon. So I feel like I'm coming back to something that was a really big interest very, very early in my academic career.
So you say you're now returning to Hildegard, but she has a massive corpus. What works of hers did you encounter initially, and what were your impressions of those?
So I think the first two things I read as part of that summer class that I took with Professors Gary and Gier, and then during the thesis, was Hildegard's Vita, which is a really interesting Vita because it's put together by several different sources. And I think uncommonly for Vitae, includes excerpts from Hildegard's own writings as well. And then I worked my way through Scivius, which is a really fun work, but also very challenging, even if you're reading in English. My Latin was not so good as an undergraduate. So I worked through those in English. But what I loved about Scivius was you had these images, right, that maybe go back to Hildegard, but that give you the sense of somebody who's working across the century range, right, who's working in text, but also image, and then also just her wonderful cycle of hymns and songs and so on. She's, a wonderful poet as well. So I would say I kind of got my start with the Vita and with Scivius, and then I think branched out from there.
So on the topic of her Vita, as avid listeners know, we've done an episode on Hildegard before, episode 8 with the wonderful Lauren Cole. So we may have covered this previously, but let's do a little bit of background biographical information. Who was Hildegard and what do we know about her?
So we're fortunate to know quite a lot, because not only do we have a trilogy of visionary writings that she produces over a span of 25, 30 years, and a number of shorter works in addition to that, but over 300 letters written by or to her. So we're able to reconstruct a lot of her life from the 1140s on. But she's born in 1098 to a noble family in the Rhine Valley. And the sort of legend goes that she was the 10th child and then was given as a tithe to the monastery at Disibodenberg to be trained by Jutta of Sponheim, who sort of starts to attract more and more noble young women, so that it becomes almost, I think, a double monastery or something approximating that by, say, the 1130s. Then Jutta dies and Hildegard takes over the community before feeling a call by God that she needs to go and establish her own foundation on the Rupertsberg, and then has to fight with her monastic superiors in order to get permission to do this. Eventually, after what one of my instructors called a bit of holy blackmail, she would lie in bed and not give any more visions until she was given permission to go and found this monastery. So then she goes, I think, in 1150 or so, and eventually founds another house in addition to that on the other side of the Rhine River. So becomes the founder of two monasteries, writer of biblical commentaries, writer of lives of local saints, and of course, visionary works, medical works, which I believe was the theme of the earlier episode. Just somebody who was very intellectually broad. And I think that's one of the really striking things about Hildegard in a time when we're told that women were not meant to have intellectual interests and be trained for these kinds of pursuits. I mean, she is just one of the most vibrant and wide-ranging writers of the 12th century, not simply for women, but I think for anyone.
And that's another really wonderful thing about Hildegard, is we do have all of these letters. And I think that this contributes to what you're saying of why we can see more of Hildegard as a person than we sometimes get with other mystics.
Yes, I think it's interesting with Hildegard because she is so reticent to write in her own voice. People send her these nice flowery greetings and she doesn't reply in kind, but you know, she'll say the living light says or something, right? She'll always write in the divine voice, sometimes in ways that are almost delightfully passive aggressive, thinking about, say, the letter from the early 1150s to Tengsten de Vandernach, who writes to criticize her about being a bit showy with the dress of the women in her community, and Hildegard putting her in her place, but in the voice of God. So depending on how we read these letters, we can see her personality, we can see her self-confidence, might be one way of putting it, and feeling that God has chosen her for this and that the way she is doing things is the right thing. She doesn't respond well to people trying to correct her as much as she goes and corrects other people, including bishops and prelates and so on. So we definitely get to see a bit of her personality, even though she would, of course, say that it's not her personality, but that's simply God's words that she's transmitting.
I mean, that's one way to put it, but with the number of people that God is purportedly talking through during this period, I feel like we get a lot of tones.
Absolutely. Yes, God has many personalities in the Middle Ages, yes.
Exactly. So one of the questions with Hildegard is whether or not she counts as a mystic. Now, I'm of the mind that if you can count, you can count. I don't like drawing that line particularly harshly. But in your mind, what makes her a mystic? What makes her stand out from other mystics in this period that makes this even a question?
I think Hildegard, she's uncommon in a number of ways. For example, in part of this may be the time in which she lived, she's very resistant to embrace the kind of nuptial or marital language that comes to define so many later female mystics. She's very attentive and descriptive of her own experiences of the divine. She does not have these kinds of ecstatic experiences, but I think in some ways that's what's most interesting about her, that she frames her visionary experiences, I think, in a very self-consciously epistemological way, in that, you know, not maybe so explicitly, but she's trying to carve out for herself, I think, an alternative way of knowing or experiencing the divine through her ability to look with the eye of her soul, this inner eye, into the living light. So she tends not to get caught up in these rapturous experiences. There do seem to be moments when she'll say that the divine presence is sort of more directly available to her, when she sees not just the shadow of the living light, as she describes almost this field of vision that she looks to, where she sees these things that God's revealing to her, but she hasn't experienced the living light itself, which is very fleeting and causes her a lot of bodily pain. But I think her mysticism is one of trying to render a description of how one might come to knowledge of divine things in ways that don't rely on ordinary outward modes of perception.
And how does she access this information? Is it ritualistic? ecstatic? Is it available to everyone? What's the process?
So I'm working on an article on this, which we'll see when it'll come out. But the really interesting part of her correspondence comes on this subject, I think, comes from late in her life. She gets a letter from Guibert of Jambleau in Belgium, who is a monk who's very interested in her visionary experiences and writes her a couple letters asking, you know, what happens? Do you go into a state of ecstasy? Do you remember what you experienced? And Hildegard lets a couple of letters pass and then finally writes back to him, I think kind of sternly. I mean, you have to read between the lines to see this, but she's very emphatic that this is a special form of sight that she has been gifted with, that she has this inner mode of perception that she talks about as far back as her first letter to Bernard of Clairvaux from about 1146, and also in the preface to Scivias. But she talks to Guibert about how she sees with this particular mode of perception. It's almost an out-of-body experience, though she also remains in the body. So she can kind of see two ways at once. I mean, it's hard to translate this letter because it's hard to grasp exactly what she's saying. And the question of whether or not it's accessible to everyone, the argument I want to develop is that it used to be before the fall. So if you read this in tandem with her Solutiones, which she also writes to Guibert and the monks of Jambleau, who write her with 38 questions that she responds. And Beverly Mayne Kienzel has a great monograph on Hildegard's biblical interpretation and notes that Hildegard is the only female author in the medieval period that we know of who wrote in this very technical exegetical genre, not simply sort of weaving that into visionary works, but also under the divine inspiration here. So she's not writing in her own voice. And she has several places in there where she talks about what happens in the fall is that you have the sort of blinding of the soul's eyes and the opening of the body's eye, that there is a kind of shift in the way that humans interact with and perceive the world as a result of the consumption of the forbidden fruit and the casting out of paradise. And if we read this letter in tandem with some of these soluciones, what you come to see is that the kind of vision that Hildegard is claiming to have is the kind of vision that Adam and Eve possessed before the fall. And so she is divinely gifted this in the same way. I mean, quite not humbly, she says that just like Paul or, you know, John the Evangelist sees these things, I see these things, right? So there's so much that's interesting about this letter because Guibert is trying to praise her as being like the Virgin Mary. He uses the Song of Songs to praise Hildegard. And we're starting to get into this period of time where you have Marian interpretations of the Song of Songs. And Hildegard's just not interested in Mary in this context. She has a number of Marian hymns, but she's not interested in likening herself to Mary or Deborah or anybody else. It's a female character of the Hebrew Bible. She sees herself as like the guys who wrote the Bible, which I think is really interesting and often gets missed, I think, in our interest in talking about the humility trope and how female mystics authorize themselves and so on. But she thinks that she sees like them. She sees like Adam and Eve saw before the fall, maybe not fully as they did, but recapturing this. So I think that's to kind of go back to your earlier question about, you know, is Hildegard a mystic? I think it's a difficult word to define, right? What are we talking about exactly? Is it about altered states of consciousness? And I think so often when we talk about mysticism, we're interested in ways of relation to the divine. But what I think Hildegard is most interested in is thinking about ways of human perception and knowing. This is just, it comes up again and again in her letter to Guibert that she says, what I see, I know, right? I know, and I have an understanding of everything that I see. Ask me if I remember these things. Yes, thank you very much. I do remember these things, but I also have a full understanding of them. She's like, what I don't see, I don't know, right? So for her, it's not simply a question of relating to God, of having some kind of ecstatic union with God, which we might sometimes think of as being the end goal of rapture or, again, the kind of Eucharistic mysticism that becomes so much of a hallmark of the 13th and 14th centuries, but a very deep investment in claims to the knowledge that she might have of who God is and how the world is.
And I mean, this connection with the apostles, just what she's saying about not knowing if she's in the body or out of the body when she's experiencing things, that's St. Paul and the three heavens all over.
Right, exactly. Absolutely. Yeah.
And it is really interesting to see a female mystic make a claim for her own authority through the same route that we have for the male fathers of the church. We often see them claiming that authority through the Virgin Mary or indeed not really claiming the authority themselves, but instead being framed with such humility that the authority is then put onto them by other people. So it's really interesting to see her claim that in such a clear manner.
Yes, I think that's what's really interesting. I think sometimes we're so interested in this question of how did women find a voice, right, in this time when they were not officially permitted it really in any form? and that we can see these kind of visionary things as maybe concessions. I think what's really interesting about Hildegard is it's not a concession. In fact, I'm recovering a kind of primal mode of knowledge, of perception, of sight that maybe in the eschaton everyone will get, but I have it now. She never says that explicitly. I think you have to kind of piece some things together, but I think it fits more generally with Hildegard being confident in herself and in the things that she knows and in her vocation. She doesn't seem to waver much in that. She seems to have a deep level of certainty and is more than happy to run with the big dogs and insert herself in conflicts and controversies.
I mean, absolutely. We love a controversial woman. Well done, Hildegard. But when you talk about this idea of I saw and I understand, what does that actually mean? How does that come to be? Obviously, in some cases, we have mystics who have an angel that guides them around through a vision or a divine voice that explains things to them. What is happening for Hildegard? How does she come to this understanding?
She doesn't really have a mediating figure, an angelic figure. She uses the language of interiority, talking about a warming in her breast, an inflaming of the mind, hearing God speaking at the beginning of Scivius, speak and write. This is, you know, said to her a number of times. So she does have these dialogues with a divine voice somehow, but it never manifests really in any kind of human figure. We don't get what we see, for example, with Catherine of Siena, 2 centuries later, almost encountering Jesus and, you know, having some sort of marital ceremony with, right? Like, she doesn't have that kind of physical, tangible thing. And I think this is why, especially in the 70s and 80s, there was so much modern medical, psychoanalytic interest in Hildegard, asking whether or not she suffered from migraines and these kinds of things, because so much of her language really is an interior language, one that makes sense, I think, or can at least be studied in the terms of modern psychoanalysis, modern neuroscience, that kind of thing. Not, I saw a person who I could touch, and so on. And we get bits and pieces of how this works. In this letter to Quibert, she talks about the shadow of the living light. It's like seeing things reflected in a pond, in a sense. Like, she looks into it and sees heavenly things reflected there, and then she writes things down. And what's really interesting, for example, about Scivius and all the visionary works is that they're keyed as interpretations of vision. So it's everything is divinely given. She's not, in her own words, in her own framing of this, not providing her own interpretations of anything, but each section of the work starts with a vision that she receives, and then she interprets the vision, but the interpretation she also has, again, presumably by looking into this shadow of the living light. So there's no engagement with guiding angelic figure who explains things to her. She sort of explains it to herself under divine guidance. And that's the other interesting thing about Hildegard. If you look at some of the Scivius manuscripts, when you have the vision itself that she's receiving, and especially when it recurs, so she'll return to that vision as part of the interpretation. In some of the manuscripts, it will actually be underlined or rubricated in some ways and set apart from the interpretation, much as you might expect to see a scriptural passage, for example, set apart. And so there really is, I think, a good case to be made that Hildegard actually sees these visions that she's receiving in a way as scriptural, as being fully authoritative, which again, maybe goes back to this very strong self-confidence that she has in herself and these visionary experiences. But we don't know what this process looks like. We do know that she worked very closely with her scribe, Volmar, when she was devastated upon his death in, I believe it's like 1173. So he died a few years before Hildegard does. And I mean, I think one of the other just notable, incredible things about Hildegard is that for all the illness and pain that she struggled with in her life, she lived a very, very long time. But we know that she worked closely with Volmar, but we don't know technically what that looked like, how long their sessions lasted, what state she was in as she was dictating these things to Volmar. Of course, there's that famous illumination, which I actually have on my office wall in a print, of sort of fiery tentacles almost coming down from heaven, sort of massaging the top of Hildegard's head while she sits there with her own wax tablet, right? She's writing on a wax tablet with Volmar kind of looking on. So again, who knows how much that actually relates to, did Hildegard sit there and write her visions on a wax tablet that Volmar then transcribed into a manuscript? Hildegard does express, you know, hesitance with her own Latin, her own ability to compose and to write. So we don't know practically what that looked like. Did she sit there quietly? Did she have to do anything, you know, as you mentioned, rituals or anything she did to get into this state, to center herself? That's what we have to speculate and don't know.
You mentioned that she had a close relationship with her scribe, but she had more than one, right?
So she wound up having two. So there's Volmar, and then she winds up connecting with Guibert Jean Bleu. He becomes the scribe who succeeds Volmar for the last few years of her life. So they eventually do establish communication by letter, and then Guibert leaves his monastery to spend time at the Rupertsburg Monastery and stays there after Hildegard's death, where he sort of takes responsibility for finishing her vita as well. And we have letters in his own epistolary corpus writing back, where the monks in his abbey are like, so when are you coming back, and trying to draw him back. So he was her confidant very late in life. But it's really interesting because he only got to know her in 1075, when she's already 77 years old.
It is nice to have a firm example of someone in the medieval period who lived such a long life. It always bothers me when people dismiss the medieval as, everybody was dead by 35. That's not how life expectancy works. It's not like nobody lived past their 30s. Anyway, having lived such a long life, there is a lot of life to talk about. So what are some of the aspects of her biography that really stand out to you?
That's a really good question. I'm most interested, I think, in three aspects of her as kind of monastic director, as someone who is a founder of not just one, but two communities, two Benedictine monasteries. When she takes the Benedictine part of this very seriously, she has her own commentary on the rule of St. Benedict that she writes. And there was always this question about how adaptable monastic rules are, right, that are written for men and need to be composed also for women. But these questions of how do you write texts that may have been intended for men and adapt them to women, because monasticism generally started out as a male eremitical phenomenon. And as women are gradually added into this with Cenobitic monasticism, how do you integrate them? And Hildegard writes her own commentary on the rule of St. Benedict. So I'm really interested in this. I'm also interested in this part of her kind of leadership and her fostering of other women in her communities and so on, and the way she does and maybe also doesn't do this. So as someone who's interested in women's history in the Middle Ages as well, you know, not just within the confines of mysticism, there's a lot of overlap simply because that was, you know, a form of religious experience that tended to allow women to speak outside of the social constraints put upon them. But, you know, Hildegard clearly has a very close relationship with Ricardus of Stade, who's in her monastery and then leaves to go become an abbess elsewhere. And Hildegard thinks it's a bad idea. And then Ricardus dies. And Hildegard sort of feels bad, but is a little like, I told you so. She is clearly very supportive of Elizabeth as well, who is a very different kind of visionary, right? She has revelations that are given to her by an angel in her works. So we have a few letters between the two of them. But Hildegard does not seem, interestingly, to have been particularly interested in a sense of bringing other women along. I think what's also really interesting about Hildegard is this very difficult relationship to parse out between her and Jutta. Jutta's life, which was only, you know, recently in the last couple of decades published, does not mention Hildegard, which is very strange, because if Hildegard really was the chief pupil and the person who is naturally her successor, why does Hildegard not appear there? And Hildegard is very taciturn about Jutta in her own writings. And she writes two vitae, one of St. Rupert and the other of St. Disibod, two people who are associated with monastic foundations that she was a part of, but she did not write the life of Jutta. And so I'm interested in Hildegard, the monastic leader, the monastic founder, the spiritual director, and what that looks like in terms of how she helped to promote other women in her care, and maybe didn't, right? And didn't promote the cults of other, you know, female saints who went before her, as the case with Jutta, which I think is really interesting. I'm also interested in Hildegard the musician.
Yes, absolutely. Hildegard is a musician. Please tell us more about that, because it is so important to her legacy.
You know, that's the part of Hildegard, I think we can talk about, you know, Hildegard's endurance, because her legacy in the Rhine Valley really does live on very strongly through the renewed monastic foundation in Eibingen. But Hildegard, the musician, I mean, of course, this was the way she's known, I think, to most people now. I think the first recording of her music, the first modern recording, was in 1985-ish, the Feather on the Breath of God, which wound up, I think, both winning a Grammy and got selected by the Library of Congress of one of the albums from the 20th century that are highly culturally significant and should be promoted going forward. There's a composer a few years ago, I think a Norwegian composer, so I'm not going to attempt to pronounce his name, but even 3 years ago has a selection from her Ave Generosa on his album, I think it's like 2017. So that kind of endures, but there's just such interest, I think, in her music. It's really beautiful when you hear it performed. It's kind of amazing to hear something performed, something that would have been performed in roughly the same way 800 years ago, to be able to experience that now. I think that's really quite something. And then I think Hildegard as a biblical interpreter is just really interesting, right? Like, how did she engage with sacred texts that she wasn't supposed to be reading, but yet found a way to comment frequently on scripture throughout her life?
On the music front, listeners who follow the podcast on Twitter, you will find a tweet where I've included a link to some of Hildegard's music. But one of the things that I've always found very interesting about Hildegard is the explicit requirement of her to preach, because obviously that was very contentious in this period. Women are not meant to be preaching in this historical moment, and yet here she is doing just that, without a lot of evidence that there were objections to this behavior. That's really interesting.
Right. She goes on a number of preaching tours. She'll go one time down the Main River, the Rhine River. I mean, she does these, right? And she preaches in churches, as far as we understand. And, you know, no one says anything about it that we know. There's no complaints. We don't hear about this where she's responding to somebody who says, why are you doing this? There are moments in the hagiography that suggest conflict, where there's sort of unnamed critics who are saying, there's so many wise men around, but this foolish woman is receiving these visions. So she definitely must have had her detractors. We all know enough about celebrity culture to know that nobody is immune from criticism. Nobody wins everybody over. And especially when she really was pushing the bounds of what was permissible for women to do, certainly we get, you know, kind of background noise of people wondering whether or not this is something that's licit for her to do. And also women pushing back. Some of those critical letters come from other women. But I think you're right. What's most interesting is that we don't see more of it, and that she really did have so many opportunities to teach and to preach. But also that for all she wrote, her cult definitely flourished in places, but she was never officially canonized, not until 2012, I suppose, when she was also made a doctor of the church. So we have the Acta Inquisitionis. So they sent people, they investigated the miracles. There's a really interesting document, but the canonization process never concluded, which is interesting considering the fact that so many women who were far less active, who wrote far less, who did not found, you know, multiple communities and so on, were canonized quite quickly. So maybe there are more hidden objections to Hildegard that haven't surfaced in the historical record, but maybe we can surmise that part of the holdup with the canonization process was to do with that. But I'm also not an expert in medieval canonization, so you should generally take most things I say with a grain of salt.
Oh, absolutely. Anyone who's listening to this and taking notes for some sort of scholarly project, don't. Please, we are not peer-reviewed. Please, we are not peer-reviewed. It is weird, though, that Hildegard wasn't canonized, that it took so long for that to happen, especially given that she had a strong community that she founded and that carried on after her death. We have other mystics, like Dusalene, who do create a community around themselves, but then upon the death of that one charismatic leader, they get enveloped into other religious organizations. But that is not the case for Hildegard. Her community lived on.
Absolutely. Someone like Dusalene, I mean, with the suspicion that Beguines are held in, it's really interesting. I mean, Hildegard was a Benedictine, right? She was part of the only game in town for a period of time. She wasn't writing her own rule. And I mean, I think this is the really interesting thing about Hildegard, and maybe just a part of her political savvy in some ways, but, you know, she played the game too. She was very supportive of the Gregorian reform. She very much promotes clerical hierarchy, clerical celibacy. She is very clear in Scivius that, like, there should be no ordination of women. There should be no women performing sacraments. But you're right, her communities have a very, very long legacy. The Rupertsburg Foundation is until the 1660s, I believe. It's until the 17th century that it survives until it's destroyed. And then the monastery on the other side in what's now Rüdesheim am Rhein is early 19th century when it is basically seized and shut down. And then in about 100 years later, in 1904, you know, in Eibingen, just at the hill that sort of overlooks Rüdesheim, you have a foundation or a renewed Hildegardian foundation that's established that is now a functioning Benedictine community with, I believe, 30 or 40 nuns. And it was actually in the mid-20th century home to very important Hildegard scholarship. The first critical edition of Scivius that was produced by two sisters at Eibingen Abbey. Also, I believe it was in the 1930s, they copied the Rupertsburg Scivius, which was the illuminated Scivius, which if you ever see, if you Google Scivius illuminations, you'll see these things. And we don't have the original manuscript. It's an interesting story that for whatever reason, in the 1930s, they decided they wanted to have their own copy of it. So they, I think four or five sisters worked on basically copying the illuminations, the script. If you look at the black and white photos of the Rupertsburg manuscript that survive, it's actually incredibly impressive how close these two things are together. And to think about this, the scribal skills that were still in existence in the early part of the 20th century, Then the Second World War, there was real concerns that the bombings would lead to destruction of that manuscript and also the Lohizen Codex, the big, huge honking thing. This thing is huge. It's got nearly all of Hildegard's works. They've digitized it. It's in the Wiesbaden library right now. And you can see all, it's really just kind of amazing to see this. And they moved both of them to Dresden for safekeeping. And after the war, the Rupertsburg Scabious is gone. And we still don't know where it is. It's presumably somewhere. I mean, I don't know. I mean, no one does. So it's one of these, you know, almost Dan Brown-esque, you know, what happened. But her legacy very much lives on in this community. You can even go and buy bottles of wine that are named after different ones of Hildegard's works. And you can find different illuminations from Scabious on the, you know, you can buy wine that has, you know, Scabious illuminations on them. So Hildegard has been a presence in central Germany, and her cult has been celebrated there for a millennium. So it really is interesting that it took until 2012. And really the former Pope Benedict, Joseph Cardinal Ratzinger, who really actually started moving the case for Hildegard's canonization and elevation as doctor of the church.
So you did mention at the beginning of the podcast that Hildegard is someone that you are coming back to. What is it about her and her works that you think make her a particularly intriguing subject of study?
I think the only thing I would say is that she writes in so many genres and on so many different things that I think she's got a little bit of something for everybody. And that if music is your thing, if, you know, biblical scholarship is your thing, if crazy visions are your thing, there's different places to start. And I think it's really nice that there is no, you know, one person who has kind of colonized Hildegard's studies. And there's so many entry points. And I think so much still left to be written. I think, you know, she's one of the more popular people to write on, but also when you consider the vast size of her corpus, I think she's probably been understudied. You know, if you were to think about male theologians who wrote as much as she did, the fact that there's still only a small handful of monographs on Hildegard and a fairly short biography, great biography by Sabine Flanagan, but still very short. I think there's still a lot left to be done.
I mean, particularly as she did write so many different things in so many different genres, we can't really expect one scholarly work to cover it all when she didn't cover it all in one of her works either. She was an absolute polymath, and there's just so much there that still deserves more attention.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, Carl, you have shared quite a bit on why she is so interesting and why you love her so much, but if you had to sum it up, why would you say that Hildegard von Bingen is your favorite mystic?
I think to go back to where we started, she was really the first female Christian writer, first female Christian theologian, visionary, however you want to frame her, that I was exposed to. And I've just been fascinated by her and her writings and her music ever since then. I think she's someone who pays huge dividends to study. You can sit and listen to her music. You can go and visit her, you know, a monastic foundation dedicated to her. And I think that's really what's interesting, that she continues in some ways to have this kind of lived presence that you can interact with. That often is, you know, ancient and medieval historians, we don't always get the chance to do that. And there are still communities of women who are living in a foundation devoted to her, performing her music, people who continue to kind of bring her in a lived way into the modern world. I think there's not a lot of people we can say that about. And I think that's one of the things that just makes her really kind of special and enduring and would put her on my, you know, the top of my list.
That is fantastic. Carl, thank you so much for joining me today and for telling me all about Hildegard von Bingen.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciated it.
And thank you all for listening. You can follow us on Twitter at MyFaveMystic and join me next time when I speak to Ed Vandermolen about Marie de Mai.